From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the year 1561 in Scotland. Mary, Queen of Scots, was battling a number of ailments, and her physicians were considered at the time some of the finest in the world. They helped diagnose several conditions, and they also described her struggles in detail. Centuries later, modern doctors would look at their notes and conclude that, very likely, Mary, Queen of Scots, almost certainly had anorexia. Eating disorders are not new, but there is not a whole lot of research or even a real approach to adults, for example, with anorexia. There is new research happening right now that is helping us understand them and helping us all understand what we can do about them. Millions of Americans live with an eating disorder. The numbers show that less than 1 in 10 with an eating disorder receives any treatment for it. And this is a potentially deadly situation. In fact, eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. This hour, let's look at the research, let's talk about what's going on now, and what we all can do. Let me welcome my guests in studio. They include Mary Tantillo, who is the founder of The Healing Connection, and she is, boy, your resume goes a long, long way, but she is the director of the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders. That's WNYCCCED. It's great to have you here, Mary.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
And we've got a mother-daughter pair here as well. Michelle Morales is here. She is a parent peer mentor for WNYCCCED. Nice to see you here.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Alyssa Morales is 18 years old. She's an advocate for eating disorder awareness. She's the 2013 Golisano Children's Hospital Miracle Kid and was diagnosed with anorexia nervosa in recovery now. Alyssa, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with your story, Alyssa. You're 18 years old. You and your mom are doing these really important things for our community. But let's walk back through your own story, because your story, now, as we now know, of course, it's not unique. I mean, there are millions of people who deal with this, who go through it. Did you at some point realize there was something going on? Did others bring it to your attention? Can you walk me through that a little bit?
Well, my illness started when I was 12. I moved to a different school. I started doing different sports, and my anxiety went through the roof, and I was only 12, so I didn't really know what anxiety was or what it meant to manage, and I turned to food because it was something I could control. And at first, I was praised for it because I was a runner. I was doing cross country, and people just saw me, you know, getting faster and my times getting better. And it wasn't until my parents noticed that something was wrong physically, that I, you know, was withdrawing from my friends and my family, that I needed a little bit more support.
Michelle, what did you notice? Take me through that a little bit.
Alyssa is normally a very social person. She started school, got involved with what the normal teenager would be getting involved with. But as time went on, I could see the unsurety in herself and her personality. And then she started isolating herself, and I could see more depression. And then there was great weight loss. So at that point, it was time for us to take her to her doctors.
Alyssa, when you were running and you're participating in sports, did those around you, and did you yourself even think, well, weight loss is part of being an athlete? I'm running. I'm active.
Oh, definitely. I knew it was kind of a, I wouldn't say competitive in the nature that most people think of it, but when you're running, you just want to be better. And my coach would always tell me, oh, I want you on varsity next year. And for me, that meant pushing to the limits. And, you know, my friends would joke about, like, oh, we're running now, we can eat more. And so it was, there was kind of like a whole weight-conscious culture that surrounded it that I was being introduced to, but also that my brain was latching onto as well.
At 12, 13 years old?
Yes.
Yeah. Your mom said you lost a lot of weight, but at some point, Did you consciously stop eating? How did you sort of manage that? You said that was one thing that you felt you could control was food. How did you do it?
Well, when I first started, I think I never exercised as rigorously as I was doing in cross country. So I think I began to eat like I was eating normally, and then the stressors started coming up. And I started thinking, well, oh, I'm running now. I have to start cutting out fats. I need to build muscle mass, so I need to eat more protein. And then it just got so severe to the point where I would stand in front of the refrigerator after dinner, and I would still be hungry, and I couldn't decide what to eat. I was thinking like, oh, okay, that yogurt has too many grams of fat, or that's too much carbs, or is that really a healthy option, Alyssa? And it just became a spiral that eventually was too exhausting to stand there in front of the refrigerator for 30 minutes when I could be doing homework, that I just threw my hands up and said, okay, if you can't decide, you're not going to eat.
Did you eat meals with family?
I had supper with them every night, and it was difficult, I think, because I would eat smaller portions. And I believe at that time, no one really, people were starting to notice, but an eating disorder was nowhere on our radar.
And how old at this point?
12 years old.
12, okay, still 12. Okay, so
yes.
So this is all happening. And did you at any point consciously say to yourself, my body can't afford to eat food, I don't want to eat food, or was there any sort of a conscious moment where you even entertained the idea that something abnormal was going on in your mind about food?
I believe when I went in for, I had gone to my doctor's appointment, because my parents said that there was something, you know, off, and they suggested anorexia. And I remember driving home, and I thought, I can't have anorexia. I eat. I'm fine. And the next day after that was my varsity test for cross country. And I went in, and I couldn't finish the sit-ups. And I was beating myself up for that. And I look back now, and I can see that my body was deteriorating. It wasn't anything that I could have done, but it was because I was not eating.
Okay, and that's another question I had, because, you know, you're running, you're competing, you're an athlete. Maybe early on you're thinking it's normal to want to be in shape. You think about food, you eat less food, you maybe you lose weight. But your body can't keep performing at a high level if you're not bringing in nutrition, right?
Of course, yes. My body was running off of anxiety is kind of the way that I like to put it. I was tired. I was cold all the time. I was very withdrawn. But my anxiety and my desire to be the best, to not be looked upon as worthless or useless in the eyes of my coaches and my teachers and my family, that just fueled me and continued to. And I honestly don't know how I'm still here after all of that, looking at the biology.
Wow. We know that kids at times can be rough on other kids. Kids can be rough about weight, but kids who are overweight tend to deal with that more often. Did you hear anything from your peers about your physical appearance as you were losing weight?
Yes. I had a couple friends tell me, you know, Alyssa, you look scary skinny. And I would look in the mirror and say, okay, I don't know what you're looking at, because this is completely the opposite of what I see. And my friends even started to kind of pull back from me because they were scared. I had a friend, you know, who didn't understand at all, and we ended up stopped being friends mm-hmm. because she couldn't understand. You know, I came to her and I said, I think the doctors said they think I have anorexia. And she freaked out, because what do you do with that? Not many people know how to handle or how to support someone with an eating disorder.
I didn't. I mean, I said before the hour began, we were talking, I had a college girlfriend with an eating disorder, and I probably did everything wrong. You know, and that's part of our conversation this hour is, you know, there's maybe no perfect action, but we can talk about things that we all can do better. But let me ask your mom then, Michelle, you know, her friends were noticing. Were you scared? Did you at one point think, you know, she could really be in danger?
The weight loss was certainly concerning to me. I probably wasn't scared at that point, because I felt like, okay, I got her to the doctors, we got the care, so I felt fairly confident that things were going to be great. And then probably after she was diagnosed, about a month later, when she was, she had to go to the hospital, that's when I started to kind of lose that confidence and start to get really scared as to what was going on. And it was because we were seeing the behaviors, and I just thought, well, she gets the care, you know, we're going to be able to fix this. And it was not the case.
How much did you know about anorexia at the time?
Not everything. Probably every other parent knows. Weight loss, very thin, gaunt, unhealthy looking, but not really understanding the causes of it. Mm-hmm. Not certainly understanding that it definitely is an illness, but it was through a lot of education and great support with our medical staff that we've been in touch with that has helped us through all this to give us that education.
Now, first of all, Mary Tantillo, that I suspect you're going to step in here and say, this is a classic case. This is, we see this, you know, as much as, again, anybody who's gone through this might think, how is this happening? Why is it? You've probably seen this many, many times, yeah?
I would say people come into the illness in many different ways. So it is classic in one way, but the illness serves many different purposes. For some people, it helps solicit care. For other people, it gives them a sense of control. For other people, it really helps them regulate intense emotion, which patients are usually pretty scared of. They will run away from intense emotion before they can even name it. So there's lots of ways in. What Alyssa is describing is a perfect description, unfortunately, about what happens to someone on their way into anorexia nervosa. And the other thing that's important is that there were markers of risk that she nor her family would even know about, like her anxiety, like the move that she described. I know Alyssa, she strives for excellence, which is a good thing, but also when we're, and I'm talking about myself too now, when you're perfectionistic, we all struggle with that, right? That those are all markers that can put a kid at higher risk. And if genetically you are at risk for an eating disorder, as they run in families, then when you have enough environmental stress, like a move, having to make new friends, feeling like you have to perform to a certain level when you're on a sports team, you know, everything is changing when you're 12 and 13. Your body's changing. Everything that you're doing with your friends can be changing. So there was a lot of change, and that's pretty typical that the environment can kind of turn on vulnerable genes, and then you start seeing symptoms. In this situation, it's anorexia nervosa.
Okay. And Alyssa, do you consider yourself a perfectionist?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Mom, you smiled right away. You know.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a gift and it's a curse at the same time.
I understand. I mean, I think it's admirable that you have such high standards, but it's interesting, and yet it can impact in a negative way. But a lot of people are going to hear this and think, well, okay, you get a diagnosis, so at least you got the diagnosis. And unfortunately, a lot of people who, I don't think callously, I just think they may think, well, you get the diagnosis, so just start eating, right? You know, that's what a lot of people think, right? So Alyssa, when you got a diagnosis, what goes through your mind?
Well, I remember sitting there and the doctor gave me a meal plan. It was the first time I had ever heard of one. And I went home and I tried to eat it and follow the meal plan. But every time I pushed and said, okay, this is what the doctor say you have to have, my thoughts would go, you don't need that. You don't need that. The doctors had told me that I was at risk, so they said no more cross country. And for me, that made me feel worthless. So feeling worthless means you don't get to eat. You're not burning calories, Alyssa. You don't have to eat. So that just kind of continued the spiral. So it was very difficult, to put that fork to my mouth and say, okay, let's do this.
Okay. And physically, biologically, again, another thing people might be thinking of is, well, she's got to be always hungry. Does the body adapt to less of a food intake, and is that part of the problem?
Unfortunately, the body is wonderful, can adapt very wonderfully to starvation. And the medical there's medical problems when you have anorexia, like osteoporosis, you lose your period. There's a lot of different things that can happen, but also when you refeed people, they get into trouble medically. But so unfortunately, the body can accommodate to starvation. Starvation does have a terrible biological impact on the brain, so a lot of what you see with anorexia nervosa is part of that as well. People become very preoccupied with food, with shape, with weight. But their concentration suffers. There's lots of things that happen in the brain that, and with people who are genetically vulnerable, once you start starving, you kick off a whole cascade of things neurochemically, neurobiologically, physiologically, that keep that negative cycle going. And like Alyssa said, she's not realizing that she's kind of diving deeper into the illness. It basically, the way we all look at it in Western New York Comprehensive Care Center, is the eating disorder is a disease of disconnection. And its sole goal is to disconnect you from a genuine sense of who you are, thoughts, feelings, motivations, values, goals, dreams, and to disconnect you from other people so that it can have you all to itself. And it does this neurologically, biologically, emotionally.
I'm reading from the National Association for Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders, 20% of people suffering from anorexia will prematurely die from complications related to that eating disorder, and that does include suicide and heart problems.
Yep.
20, that's one in five. That is that is shocking. Michelle, at some point, did you come across that number? Did that hit you at all?
I was told right off the start.
You were?
Yes, so I was very aware of that, and I did see it quite often when she was in the hospital and she was losing weight. there was a point where we did think we were going to lose her because of her heart arrhythmia. So that definitely was always in the back of my mind.
How much after? Because again, we're going through Alyssa's story. You got the meal plan, the eating plan, but you questioned whether you could do it or whether you should do it or whether you deserve to do it. So did you continue to lose weight even after the eating plan, the meal plan?
Yes, okay. And that was when I was admitted into the hospital.
Okay. Michelle, did you try to sort of monitor, hey, you've got to be eating this, we've got to be following the doctor's plan?
Yeah, oh, certainly. But as you, as Alyssa said, her anxiety actually increased, mm-hmm. and it got harder to feed her, to get her to eat. And at that, then that's, as a parent, that's when you start to lose your confidence in your parenting skills, because I can't force her to eat, you know, other than sitting on top of her and shoving food down her throat.
Yeah.
I can't force her to eat, and watching the distress that she was going through was very heartbreaking as a parent.
Just today, the New York Times out with a story. 95% of people with eating disorders are between the ages of 12 and 25. Anorexia, the third most common chronic illness among adolescent girls. And we're going to get to some of your questions and comments, which have been coming in online. It's at Evan Dawson on Twitter if you want to join the conversation there. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Working through this with our guests, and I am so impressed with Alyssa Morales, 18 years old, an advocate for eating disorder awareness, someone who nearly lost her own life to anorexia. In 2013, she was a Golisano Children's Hospital miracle kid, and telling her story so eloquently now, which, Mary Tantillo, this has got to be so important, because what you encounter is that most people with eating disorders never even really get a diagnosis or treatment, let alone talk about it like this. Fair?
No, that is fair. It's very scary. Like I said, the whole goal of the illness is to keep you to itself and to isolate you from others who could be supportive. And that's why I think it's important to know kind of what your local resources are. And for example, in our area here, we have the University of Rochester School of Nursing, where we have actually Michelle's our parent peer mentor. We have a care manager, Jennifer Dry DeSanto. The Healing Connection is the main intensive psychological program for eating disorders in and around Monroe County, and Golisano Children's Hospital obviously has the inpatient unit. But the illness's main thrust is to have you to itself, and it's not surprising that people who are sick for years and years and years end up getting so isolated and so disconnected from themselves and others that they do die. Social isolation itself can kind of lead you down that path. The other thing that I wanted to comment on that Alyssa was talking about is that people get so distracted by the physical manifestations of the illness. So the loss of weight, vomiting, compulsive exercise. It's not that you shouldn't pay attention to those things. We have to pay attention to those things. But what people get distracted from is that all of the stuff going on inside. So what's not understood, as Michelle kind of said, it's hard to get the person to eat. People get so focus on that, they don't realize that inside the issues are more about the person's not processing information properly. So cognitively, like your thoughts, the feelings or internal states, all of that is not being perceived properly, even to the point of maybe being able to read people's facial recognition. That's not going well either. Like, she might look at me and I have a neutral face, but she's interpreting it as angry. There's lots of neurobiology to suggest, like something called the insula, which takes outside information and integrates it with your internal states. Like when you get that yucky feeling inside, that's the circuits coming in there are not synthesized properly. So when Alyssa sits down to eat a meal, she's processing this very differently, and she's not experiencing a sense of reward that you and I might feel when we're sitting down to a meal, because humans are programmed that way to have reward. It's kind of reversed for her, and all the anxieties that she has about, is she good enough? Does she have the right friends? Is she performing well enough? Are getting transferred because of part of that problem with information processing onto weight and shape. And it's not really that. It is that, but it's not really that. So you have to kind of refeed people that back and get to what she's really frightened about.
How long were you hospitalized?
I was hospitalized the first time for 17 days.
But 17 days, mm-hmm. Okay. And what kind of treatment is happening there?
There's a lot of refeeding. That was the main goal, because you come into Golisano and you're there for physical, because you need to get your weight back up to a more stable place where your brain is healthy enough to function and think about, okay, I do have an eating disorder and it's time to recover. So a lot of just meal support, sitting down, making sure that you have the proper nutrition. There was therapy, got to meet with different therapists, psychiatric doctor. So coming at it from all different angles, but it really is the baseline, the first step to get your brain back up to par so that you can continue with recovery.
17 days the first time. Did you go back for more treatment?
Yes.
Okay. When did that happen?
About 6 months after the first hospitalization.
Similar problem, just weren't eating and dealing with the same kind of problems?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mom, at that point, you know, second time in, what are you thinking as a parent?
Well, what I since have learned, so for a person that has an eating disorder, food is actually their medicine, just like insulin is for a diabetic. Mm-hmm. So although she left the hospital, she was weight stabilized. What it actually did is kind of had a side effect. It actually increased her anxiety. And so she left the hospital and she came home. And so she may have been physiologically stable, but now she was mentally unstable. And so it's very easy for someone to get back into their normal environment and get exposed to the things that they left and just fall apart at that point. And that's exactly what happened. And not us not having the, as parents, not knowing what to do with that, we did the best that we could. Mm-hmm. But ultimately it wasn't enough and she ended up back in the hospital.
You can't just will yourself to eat, I assume, at times, right? Again,
no.
How many of your friends or people around you said, you got to eat, just eat?
Oh, my gosh. I'd have to say all of them. The struggle is, it's something that most people just don't understand because they see what Mary, like Mary said, the behaviors. They see the weight loss. And for me, it has nothing to do with the food. It could be anything, you know, but it's all about the anxiety and how I process my emotions.
Okay. And your second stay, you were in the hospital for how long?
17 days as well.
17 days. And at that point going forward, you know, take me from there to now. Here you are, a miracle kid in 2013, this advocate doing such important work at the age of 18. How long did it take for you to feel, you know, I don't know if there's a new normal or stabilized, comfortable? How did that happen?
Well, it took about 4 years, in and out of treatment centers, struggling with the same behaviors, and, you know, shifting of the behaviors and everything like that. And then my recovery has been very slow, as I believe it is for most people. I can't say there was a moment when I said, oh, I'm done with this, but there were pieces. I started to lose people in my life because of my eating disorder. I started to, you know, I was held back in school on certain courses, and it began to infiltrate my life in places where I never believed it would touch. Because when I'm thinking about it, I'm like, oh, it's just food. You know, this is just my eating. It's not going to affect my family. It's not going to affect my friends. And so I think slowly I began to see and get upset with where it was trying to take over. And then I began actually, instead of just sitting in treatment centers and saying like, yeah, okay, that's great, I started, you know, taking in the information and applying it to my life and to my own recovery.
You had a different mental reaction to what was going on then with it, it sounds like.
Yes.
Okay. You know, for the listening audience, we are going to spend much of the second half hour talking about what we all can do. We're going to talk about ongoing research, what's going on now, what parents can do. But I just keep coming back to how impressive someone like Alyssa is to be able to communicate this effectively. And I have to think that her mom feels the same way. I mean, if you go back 4 or 5 years, to think that we'd be sitting in the studio and she'd be an advocate, you're shaking your head.
There's no way. Alyssa has been a true champion for people that have eating disorders because she eloquently has gone out there and been able to, I think, bring a new light of information that did not exist before. And it's because of her struggle, because of her experience, because of her journey. So she definitely has a gift, and she's using that special gift now.
let me ask a very ignorant question. I'll ask Alyssa and Mary this question. Most of us in the listening, I'm sure everybody who can hear my voice right now knows someone who has alcoholism. And what we know for addicts is that doesn't go away. You know, you get to different points in your life, but that doesn't mean that you wake up one day and say, well, I'm not an alcoholic anymore. I don't know with anorexia, does it, you know, you're in recovery is the way you described it. Does anorexia go away? Do you consider yourself as still being anorexic? How do you describe it, Alyssa?
Personally, I think I strongly dislike my eating disorder. And so I consider myself in recovery, but the thoughts are still there. The body image issues are still there. And I can't say, I don't know if they'll ever go away completely, but I will learn to manage it because I'm capable of seeing my life beyond food and beyond weight. And, you know, there just comes a point when you start to look at yourself as a whole person, and then anorexia kind of fades to the wayside because you're focused more on what you can do and what you have to offer to this world. And you start to see that number, and that number has no meaning anymore.
Are you concerned, or do you guard against possible relapse? You know, what happens if you start to feel anxiety, stress, you find yourself, you know, really struggling with the question on food and those kind of things? How do you plan to deal with that?
In all honesty, it is very difficult. I still struggle with, especially this is my first semester in college, another big change. And my eating disorder has definitely infiltrated and tried, you know, to take over places in my life. And talking with my support team and my parents especially, I'm starting to see places where my expectations are too high, or, you know, my illness tries to use coping mechanisms. Like if I'm trying to deal with a stressful exam that's coming up, my illness tries to say, okay, well, don't eat as much here, or do this or do that. And it's all about really just being mindful and taking into consideration that I don't really want to be where I was before, and that my eating disorder has no power over me as long as I say that it doesn't and believe it.
An email from Angela just says, crying and cheering. Thank you. I've been there. So many need to hear this. That's just one example. I'm getting an email from someone like that. You know, there's a lot more out there who are hearing your story and really, really moved by it. Let's get a short break, and we're going to come back with our guests and talk more about what we all need to understand about eating disorders and what we all can do better. You know, me among many, many included, the way we react to people around us, support that is out there, and ongoing study. It's all coming up next right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we preview an upcoming conference on social media. It's a local conference, and no, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, they're not going away. We'll talk about the future of social media, how to use it successfully when it's overused, with not only local experts, but people from Time Magazine and Marvel Comics as well. Then second hour, Rajesh Barnabas, the Green Party candidate for Monroe County Executive.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, welcoming conductor laureate Christopher Seaman for Brahms' Fourth Symphony, plus NPR host and pianist Christopher O'Reilly plays Mozart this Thursday and Saturday. Tickets at rpo.org.
We are talking about eating disorders, and I'm joined in studio by 18-year-old Alyssa Morales, who is telling us her story of living with anorexia and the fact that she's in recovery now, how she got here, and what we can learn from her story. Her mother is Michelle Morales, who's a parent peer mentor for WNYCCCED. That's the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders. And Mary Tantillo is here as well. She's the director of WNYCCCED. Among many other things. And you've got the second longest title I think I've ever had from an interview. I want to talk recovery in just a second. What I also want to do is shine a little bit of a light on what bothers me and what should bother us. And that's the way sometimes we make light of this, as if it's, again, you heard Alyssa say, even well-intended people around her said, well, just eat, right? You know you're sick, eat. Well, that's obviously well-intended by most people, even if it doesn't get it. But then you've got Hollywood that turns this into a punchline. And I want to play a montage of clips here. This is from Glee, Family Guy, Heathers, Seinfeld, and on the Disney Channel, Shake It Up. Listen to the way they turn it into a joke.
Brody is working and Rachel is in the bathroom.
Well, let's hope that she's embracing her inner bulimic, because let me tell you, homegirl has been looking extremely pumpkin-like.
Ugh, look at how fat you are. You disgust me. Oig, oig, fatty. Oh, yes, yes, you'll take butter on that English muffin, won't you? Because you're the cheerleading squad's token blimp. You don't deserve to eat.
Grow up, Heather. Bulimia's so 87.
Order me a piece of cake. I'm gonna go throw up.
You're adorable. I could just eat you guys up. You know, if I ate.
That's from the Disney Channel, that last one. I mean, of all the things that you feel like should know better. Alyssa, what do you think of when you hear that stuff?
Personally, I get very upset because it's not a joke. It's not, you know, the pain and the suffering that not only those that are affected directly by the eating disorder, but also the families and friends. It's horrific. And to hear these clips where people are talking about, you know, the appearances of others and how we're shaming those who people deem as fat. A body is a body. There's no right or wrong way to have one. And our bodies are fluid beings, and they change and they shift. And no one should have to be shamed because of the way that they look or they appear or the way that they choose to live their lives.
Michelle, what do you think of when you hear that?
Well, you certainly wouldn't say to a diabetic, well, you know, just don't feel faint because you didn't have, you know, a breakfast or something. You wouldn't talk that way to somebody who has an illness. So the stigma that exists right now is for eating disorders is we're judging everyone on a behavior that they see, and it's not about the behavior. These are people that have illnesses just as much as somebody who has a heart disease or has cancer or who has diabetes, and it needs to be treated that way.
Let me work through just a few listener questions that have come in on Twitter, and then we're going to work through what recovery means, recognition, and all of the things that go with that. Just had a few questions. Caleb wanted to know, can the panel talk about a gender component of this? Do other eating disorders manifest themselves more in boys? Mary?
Actually, there's no one face for eating disorders. They happen across gender. They happen across socioeconomic class, across ethnicity. There's this myth that they only happen to rich white girls. That's totally not the case. And also, you know, when you look at research, many men, unfortunately, talk about stigma, are socialized to think they shouldn't come to treatment, and men aren't supposed to have problems. And also, boys are not diagnosed with eating disorders for a very long time because people kind of, again, have this myth that they happen to girls. There's a lot more boys with eating disorders in the community versus in a, quote, clinic sample. There's a lot of women who come to treatment because they feel they can and they're identified. Not all the time, but mostly. But lots of boys in pediatric community samples, the ratio is more like 1 boy to 6 girls versus 1 or 2 boys to 10 girls in a clinic sample. So it depends on where your sample is that you're looking at.
Okay, and Caleb follows up and says, just wants to know if compulsive exercise does fit into all of this, or is that entirely a separate discussion?
Absolutely, it fits into this. It can definitely be a way to purge, to compensate for eating. Guys also struggle with steroid use. They struggle with what's called the Adonis complex. They have compulsive weightlifting. There's different ways. There's orthorexia. People are convinced that they're like eating healthfully, but they do it in such a way that they start losing weight and not eating proper nutritional composition of things. So there's lots of different faces to eating disorders. But I will say with the guy thing, that's very worrisome to me, because it's almost a reverse discrimination for guys. And many men suffer silently for many years,
Okay. Many years. Yeah, I think that's important to point out and for our listeners to keep in mind about this. And I want to talk about what we can do. And so let me start with Alyssa then. You heard a lot of people around you who are well-intentioned. Just eat, you know, all that stuff. What can help, if anything? What would a good friend do, and what could a good friend do for a friend who they're concerned about with an eating disorder, apart from saying, hey, I don't understand, you're not eating, you know, you're losing weight, just eat? What can a friend do?
I think it starts with education, whether that be in the community or at home, and just learning how to talk and how to conversate with someone who has an eating disorder, and then just reassuring their loved ones that they're more than a number. I think the eating disorder reduces us to a number, to an exercise routine, to your ability to eat or not eat. And when all of those thoughts are constantly going on in your head, for someone outside of you to say, hey, I see you. I see you for who you are. And I see all the things that you aren't, in the sense of, like, you're so much more than just that number. So I see everything outside of that. That can be really helpful to someone who is suffering, because it gives a third perspective that our brains wouldn't even think of to go to.
Okay. Michelle and Mary, the same question. What do you want people to do if they are concerned? And let's take the parent perspective, Michelle.
That was a very hard discussion to have, and parents ask me that question all the time. And I hope that because of my position now at the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders, I'm helping with that. And a large majority of what I do is I do educate parents. There's a lot of guilt that comes along as a parent, because a child that's been diagnosed with it, you feel like it's something that you've integrally done to your child. But that's not the case. You're the agent for change, and you love that child more than any treatment team that's around there, so you have their best interests at heart. So don't just kind of shy away from it. If you do start to see behaviors that are just not normally your child, I would seek medical care. You know, talk to your pediatrician, talk to your doctor that you trust, and just say, I've seen these things. I'm not sure. I don't know if they mean anything or not. For me, just the isolation, there was a definite shift in her personality that didn't exist before. And she was an adolescent. So at first I kind of rationalized saying, oh, well, this is just her being an adolescent. But really my gut feeling was this is not the case. So I would say to parents, please listen to your gut and to seek out, you know, ask questions. Talk to your son or your daughter and ask them the questions, you know, how are you feeling? What's going on? And I've, you know, noticed these things. Can you tell me more about them? To open the conversation and then get yourself, as Alyssa said, educated. Find out more about eating disorders. And then, you know, definitely in tandem, seek medical care.
A male listener who did not want to be identified sends us the following. Recently, I'm dealing with some scary weight loss myself from chronic stress. I'm definitely fine now, but this is not just a female thing. Most people have a problem simply understanding that you can have an unhealthy relationship with food. It really is an alien concept to many. That's from a male adult listening, but we've also had questions from listeners who want to know, how young do you see it? Mary, how young?
Well, sadly, I know of cases of kids at the age of 8. Or 7. I had a 5-year-old walk up to me once and ask me if she looked fat in a Halloween costume. I have to tell you, I almost went through the ceiling, because our culture just, like, as everyone's already pointed out, gets so physically appearance oriented that it socializes us to value ourselves from the outside in.
Okay, but one more important point there, because we've been hearing this hour that any stereotype that we have that it's just about wanting to look thin, or whatever society's definition of good looking or beautiful or hot, all of that stuff can really miss the mark here.
Totally.
But, you know, Alyssa tells us she's still, you know, it can be a struggle. You think about body image. So when you talk about body image for you, what is it related to? Because you didn't become anorexic because you were obsessed over, at the age of 12, how to look good, right? I mean, so that part of the stereotype that people would have is wrong. For now, for you at the age of 18, you're in recovery, but when you think about body image, you know, what does that mean for you?
It is always linked to stress and anxiety. So when I feel that I'm managing things well and, you know, my mood is pretty stable, my body image, I'm still not completely 100% comfortable with it, which I believe is normal for most women.
For most humans.
Yes, right? Yes.
We all have things we wish we could change.
Yes. Yeah. So in those moments, it's more manageable and I don't think about it as much as I used to. But when I get stressed, when anxiety hits me, you know, when there are certain things, emotions that I can't cope with or I'm not sure how to manage, I turn to my body and I start to see things that I didn't see there before, and my body image goes way out of proportion.
Okay. Does this sometimes come from the societal pressure to be thin, to look good, et cetera? Because again, that's where we can miss and assume that it's what it's always about to start with. But can it come from that? When you have a young kid in a Halloween costume asking you, "Do I look fat in this Halloween costume?" and they're serious, that to me says there is a weird societal standard of beauty that is starting to get infectious at a young age.
It will kind of fan the flames of a fire that genetically and environmentally kind of work together. What you want to do when girls or boys talk like that is you want to decode it. So there's a book called When Girls Feel Fat or Boys. And really, they're saying something that they're feeling uncomfortable about. It's usually not about their body. It's about how they feel uncomfortable, like Alyssa said, on the inside. Self-esteem and body esteem go hand in hand. And that starts at a very young age. And so if you feel an assault in one, kids know when they want to bother you, they go right for teasing you about your weight, about your face, and it hurts. And so they kind of, it's reciprocal. So it's not a surprise that children who get weight teased or children who feel bad about themselves, self-esteem, that all those things can kind of come together. There's, like I said, there's many rivers, biological, social, psychological, cultural, that come together. And living in a toxic culture that values thinness and connects it to beauty, success and control is just like the icing on a very big cake that's been kind of baking. And when you cruise into places like puberty, like 12, 13, or like between high school and college, there's critical windows of more stress and transition. Any time in life where you have transition, including midlife, is there a higher risk for an eating disorder? Because these guys can't deal with transition very well. It's scary. They don't like uncertainty, unpredictability, or ambiguity. And that's what life is full of. So if you're that person with anxiety in those areas, those times of life, it's going to be tougher for you.
We need better and ongoing research. What's happening right now that people could get involved with?
Thanks for asking that. At the University of Rochester School of Nursing, which is where the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders, a mouthful, is located, as well as at Galisano's. At the School of Nursing, we're doing a very cool research study. And I wanted to put a call out today for folks. If you have an anorexia nervosa, or you know of a loved one, or you know a friend or family member, to give us a call. We've left the information here. The study is cool because it's looking at multifamily therapy group. And what Alyssa and Michelle have talked about is that basically you really can't be alone with this illness. You can't recover alone. You have to be with other folks who understand the illness. So being with other families and other patients is what multifamily group is about. So the study is looking at a new intervention. It's novel because it views the illness as a disease of disconnection, and the goal is to reconnect yourself and others. And families have built this intervention over the last 10 years, and we're finally at a place where we have funding now from Hilda and Preston Davis Foundation to kind of pilot it. And I really want the families in the study, we only need 10, to basically be my co-scientists, to help me evaluate this new intervention, to tell me what's good about it, what's not so good about it, and also we'll do some typical measures, like what things are changing over time, not just weight and shape, but some of the things we talked about today, self-esteem, how you can tell what you're feeling certain things. Judy Bresch is my study coordinator there, so I wanted to encourage people to take advantage of that, because multifamily group can break the silence that patients and families start feeling, because this illness just kind of divides and conquers. So when you have people come together, they're empowered, they're empathic with one another, the patients can teach the families things, the families can support each other. There's so much expertise, so much strength, coping resources in that one little therapeutic village. So I'm biased. It's like one of the best ways that you can help people heal is putting families and patients together. You don't feel like you're alone.
You're looking for 10.
Looking for 10 for this study. Yep, and they have to be between the ages of 18 and 40. And you have to have at least one family of choice member or family of origin member come with you. You can have up to 4. So it could be your own biological family or your friends, your partner, your pastor, your rabbi, whoever. And it's a 16-session group. It runs in the evening once a week. Because the families told us that's what they wanted. And it runs over a 26-week period. And then we'll have kind of a follow-up six-month group as well. But I'm very excited because I get to partner with families to, like, make this even better. So.
Okay. They can contact you how?
They can call Judy Bresch. And you know what? You have her number right in front of you.
I've got it and you don't.
I should have it memorized right now. On that little sheet that I gave you at the School of Nursing.
Is this it?
We're looking for the piece of paper. There
this,
we go.
Look
here
at
we
this.
Go.
We have a stack of papers in the studio. We're peeling back the onion.
We're doing this in connection, on connections.
There you go.
So the number for Judy Brash is 275. I'm like squinting. 6629.
You're going to have to do that again. I
want to make sure that I have my glasses on when I do it. 275-6629 is Judy Brash. She's my study coordinator. We also have a website, which is http://.
Oh, you don't need all that stuff.
We have that here if you guys want it. Okay. So we do have a study website and we have a phone number.
No, I just mean you don't need the HTTP. It's research.son.rochester.edu/MFTG. Okay, that's how you get involved. And if you're successful, what happens? If this group, 10 families, if you're successful with this research, what comes out of it, Mary?
Well, we might actually have a treatment for anorexia nervosa in young adults that has some research behind it and that can actually not only help people with weight and shape and get rid of all those thoughts and all those worries about body, but do what's deeper, which is target kind of the internal things that are ailing people. Like the illness serves purposes, like regulating your emotion, like helping you feel in control. Maybe we can find a way to help people meet those needs mm-hmm. without having to turn to the illness. And I think being with other patients and families helps you develop those coping skills and those ways of processing things that aren't quite right when you have the illness.
Alyssa, are there ways that you cope with stress that you sort of actively try to grapple with, knowing that, you know, you're someone who's in recovery from anorexia and you don't want that to be the mechanism for handling stress?
Yes, definitely. I'm very rigid sometimes with what I eat, measuring foods, cutting out certain foods. When I start to notice those things, that's kind of my red flag for that my stress is high and I need to do something about it because I can't let my eating disorder take over again.
Is it as simple as conversation with mom, hanging out with friends, talking? Are there any stress relievers that you turn to that have helped you?
Definitely my mother. her and I are very close, and she understands eating disorders like no one else. I tell people, you know, she could build one if she had to. But definitely getting a second perspective on, like, this is how I'm feeling, this is where my thoughts, where my behaviors are, help me to see something, because I think in black and white, help me to see the gray.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The cool thing about these two is that they've developed a way so that if Alyssa is feeling disconnected from herself and can't really figure out what's going on, like she talked about rigid eating, when she tracks it back with Michelle can help her link it up to rigid thinking, right?
Yes.
Like, I have to get an A on this anatomy
test.
Yes. 'Cause really it's about the rigidity and how you're thinking and looking at things that's ailing you, but the illness doesn't want you to know that because it just wants you to keep up with the illness, right?
Exactly.
So you need someone that loves you that can help you step out of that.
Couple other quick questions from our listeners. Mike on Twitter says, amenorrhea?
Amenorrhea. Losing your period.
Okay. And decreased bone density yes. are associated with disordered eating in women. Do men get decreased bone density?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes?
And decreased testosterone. So that's true. When you don't eat enough food, you're not getting enough fat. And if you don't have fat, you can't produce hormones like estrogen or testosterone. Yes, absolutely. Men, it's a myth to think that men don't lose bone. And also, just to put out there, guys get into trouble quicker when they have weight loss. Because remember, guys don't have as much body fat. So when a guy starts precipitously losing weight, it doesn't take him long to get into trouble because he's more lean body mass.
Lori sends an email and just wanted to know, said that we've talked a lot about anorexia, haven't really talked much about bulimia, and wanted to know how closely bulimia and anorexia are related.
Like shades of gray. I mean, everyone, it's a continuum, and people can move it up and down the eating disorder continuum. And I want people to know that we didn't mean to leave out bulimia nervosa today at all, but it's a continuum. And you can move from anorexia to bulimia. You can move from bulimia to binge eating disorder, which we didn't even touch on today. It's not like a one-to-one correspondence. People can have different permutations in a family. Just because you have anorexia, your mom might have struggled with bulimia. Similar brain chemistry challenges, like with serotonin, but because genetically people are different and or they're in different environments, how your eating disorder is expressed will go one way versus another.
Okay, but they're all related.
Yes, very closely. They're very closely related.
So it's not like we've been talking mostly about anorexia, but that these are related disorders, and certainly, you know, I appreciate the comment there, Lori. I want to end on an upbeat note if we could. I'm going to go around the table, and Mary, I'll start with you. 30 seconds. You know, you've been working on these issues for years. You're finally getting more research into adult. I mean, it's amazing to hear that there's no real plan for adults, for example, with anorexia. But what's one reason that you feel like, you know, the hope for recovery is better now than it was when you started work on this?
What is my hope?
Mm-hmm.
These two people across the way from me from the table are my hope. I work with patients for over 30 years, and when I work with them and they're in groups together, there is a sense of power when I have all the families together, which is why I'm biased on multifamily group, that I feel like we could overcome almost anything. To me, when you help people reconnect with other human beings who have similar challenges, and you can come, the group is bigger, the whole is bigger than the parts. And so I've seen recovery happen. I've seen people come alive and change. And that's from people being with somebody else. So my hope is that as people join together and break the silence around this illness, they will feel more powerful and more knowledgeable, and they won't be less, they'll be less scared.
Alyssa, 30 seconds for your peers out there who may be struggling with the same kind of things that you are now in recovery from. What would you want them to hear?
Well, first, way to go. I'm so proud of you, as I know that we all struggle together. For the girls, definitely, just keep going. You're beautiful, you're strong, you're brave, and it all comes together. I know sometimes the struggle is difficult, and it feels like you can't get through, but definitely you will.
Really amazing stuff. Alyssa Morales and Michelle Morales have been sharing their story. And Alyssa, an advocate and in recovery. Michelle, a parent peer mentor for WNYCCCED. Thank you so much. Really admire you both. Thank you so much. And Mary Tantillo, thank you so much for your time as well. Hope all of the audience feels the way I did after this hour. Learned a lot about what we all can do to help those around us who are struggling with the same thing. Have a great afternoon. We will talk to you Wednesday. And thanks for the whole team here at Connections. Val LaBanca, the engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon.